This is the Michael K. Show podcast. Exclusive interviews and nonstop Team 1050 coverage. Now, it's the Michael K. Show podcast.
It's almost American League and National League Championship Series time, and what a better time I can't think of to talk with Peter Gammons of ESPN and part of our Michael K. Show family every Wednesday. Nice enough to join us today. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm really looking forward to this series. I really think I think it's going to be a great series, and I think they're the two best teams in baseball, and I think it's going to be an awful lot of fun.
I agree. So give me some of the keys you think. I'm not going to ask you to make a pick, but what's the key for the Yankees? What's the key for the Angels?
I think the key for the Yankees is simply that Burnett and pitch well. Because I think you're going to see the Angels, those, including the playoffs, the four starters for the Angels are 51 and 25 as Angels. Kazmir included in there. They're good. I mean, their bullpen, obviously, if you can get into that bullpen, I think the Yankees are so powerful. I could see them beating a Jepsen beating a Fuentes. I think it's very important that the Yankees at least stay even going into the late innings. And I think one thing that's really important in this series is that Sabathia and Pettit are going to start five games. Because I love Sean Figgins, but his on-base percentage is, if I'm not mistaken, 60 points lower right-handed than left-handed. Bobby Abreu's OPS is about 150 points lower. Kendry Morales is a totally different hitter right-handed than left-handed. And I think those are the three most important guys in the Angels lineup. And turning them around, I think, is pretty significant. And I think that's something Sabathia and Pettit can do very well.
Give me a key for the Angels then, Peter.
I think that for the Angels, that they've got to get Figgins and Abreu on, because I think that opens everything else up. I mean, we saw that against Lester in Game 1 when actually it was Ibar who got on, Figgins butted in the third, and Abreu had one of his many great at-bats and got a walk. And I think Lester just got a little frustrated and threw a fastball right down the middle, and Torrey Hunter hit it way over the rock pile. So, I think the Angels have to get those guys on. And I think, too, they've got to get about five really good starting performances out of the starters. And I'll tell you, Lackey and Weaver were great in Anaheim. And they pounded the strike zone, took away what is the Red Sox and Yankees' strength, which is, the pitch counts and being able to hit and hitters counts. They just pounded. And if they do the same thing against the Yankees, that'll be very tough. I think one advantage the Yankees have here, though, is that they get Lackey and Weaver in New York and not in Anaheim. I think they will be better off with the left-handers reversed and pitching Kazmir and Saunders in the stadium. But that's the way it falls. I mean, that's just the luck of the draw.
So Socha's going to go with four pitchers. The Yankees are going with three. Do you agree with both moves? I love the Yankees going with three because only one pitcher is inconvenienced, and that's CeCe working on 3 days rest once, which I don't think will be an issue.
I don't either because, I've heard time after time, well, remember, he ran out of gas on 3 days rest last year. Well, he pitched on 3 days rest four or five straight times. I mean, this time, Joe Girardi did such a great job preparing CeCe for this. If I'm not mistaken, you can correct me, but I think he had 5 days rest, 5 days rest, 6 days rest, 6 days rest, 6 days rest.
Yep.
And here we are. And I mean, the Yankees had a lead, allowed Joe to do it, but I thought he prepared CeCe for the three-start playoffs absolutely brilliantly. I mean, I just kept watching how he used Sabathia so that those 230-something innings that CeCe has right now are much fresher than the pressure-packed 245 and 250 innings he had the last 2 years pitching the Indians into the playoffs and also pitching, of course, the Brewers into the playoffs. So it's a very different situation. It's not just innings or number of pitches. It's the stress of those pitches and innings. And CeCe hasn't had a lot of stress this year the way he did last year.
Let's talk about some specifics with the Angels. Are we seeing the last games of Vlad's Angel career?
Yeah, I think so.
How about Abreu?
I think he'll be back. For the last month, Mike Socha has been absolutely lobbying for for him to be in the top 10 MVP balloting? I mean, I think it's a little hard because I think you can make a case for Figgins, Morales, or Abreu being in the top 10. But I'll tell you what was really fascinating to me is how much the other players revere Bobby Abreu and say he's made such a difference. I mean, Figgins said to me the other day, you know, he said, I heard you say that we went, which is pretty remarkable, from a 330 team on base to a 350 team on base. And he said, you know, I mean, I've worked at it over the years. That's fine. But Bobby Abreu is the guy who's really shown everybody exactly how you go up to the plate thinking one thing, get a good pitch to hit. And, you know, I know it sounds like Ted Williams in 1939. But Abreu's I'm amazed. I mean, you watched him. And I asked Bill Stoneman, who's still like the club president and a baseball person I just have the greatest of respect for. I asked him the other day, did you have any idea how good Abreu is? And he said, no. And I asked Mike Socha the same thing, and he did the same answer, no. Not until he got here and we could see him play every day and see him take every at-bat so seriously. Now, you understand that. I did not, and I chide myself for it. I never realized how good a hitter he is. And I got to laugh. I mean, you look at the people he's been traded for. Kevin Stocker, he's been traded for a point guard at the University of Kansas, and he signed for $5 billion. I mean, I'm sure C.J. Henry's a good point guard, but you know, I think I'd rather have Bobby Abreu.
I'll tell you what, though, Peter, and this is an interesting point. All these things that you're saying is great about Abreu. I mean, you know as well as I, the Yankees were not heartbroken that he didn't come back to them. They didn't want him to come back. So, I don't know, maybe it's a situation where after a while you don't want him there. The Phillies traded him for practically nothing, although that was money-based. The Yankees didn't even, I don't think they wanted to sign him again.
No, that's interesting. But he's, and maybe it's the situation. Maybe it's being out in Anaheim, and it's, you know, that attitude and, I think that the spirit that Socha has developed over all the years in with the Angels, I think has something to do with it. It's a great bunch of guys. And I think maybe Bobby being elevated to being a leader has really responded to him. Maybe that's part of what's made him a different player there. But they love him there, and I do believe he'll be back with a 2 or 3 year contract.
All right, now let's talk about the Phillies and the Dodgers. What are the important factors in this series, Peter?
Well, I think first of all, the Dodgers starting pitching. You know, they were very good. If someone said to us in July, Vicente Padilla is going to end the Cardinals season, we would have been down on the floor laughing, right?
Well, Mark Teixeira would be ticked off, I'll tell you that.
he the guy was great. I mean, Buck Showalter kind of called that. He said, you know, there's a lot of baggage that goes with him, but the guy is tough and he's fearless. He just, you know, I think the window of opportunity, it's a narrow window, but he's been terrific. And I think the fact that Wolf and Kershaw are left-handed help, because I think that it's better to have those left-handers, but the Dodgers have to continue to get really good starting pitching. And I think, you know, from the Phillies standpoint, I still worry about the bullpen. I was so happy to see Lidge. He's one of the finest people any of us could ever meet, but you still have to be scared about that. And the Dodgers are pretty good. Now, these things, you know, a friend of mine who's a general manager said to me yesterday, you know, these series are so strange because people draw such conclusions from them when in reality, Cardinals are a better team than the Dodgers. But these things do happen, and they snowball in short series, so but I do think the Phillies will come back hitting again against the Dodgers. I think that's going to be a wild series too. It's hard to judge whether or not Kemp, Loney, Martin, guys like that won't try to do too much. I never worry about Eath here. He's Paulo O'Neill cloned. But I don't know. I mean, you know, Manny Ramirez got 3 doubles. He still hasn't hit a fastball in about a month and a half. So we'll have to see. I'm sure the Phillies will pound him as much as they can. And maybe he'll come back. But that bat speed has not been there. And I think you're going to see the Phillies be very aggressive with him.
Have you made picks for either series yet?
Yes. I picked the Yankees and the Dodgers. And I can't really rationalize the Dodgers. I think it's such an even series. I just think that they're on one of those rolls. And I think maybe the whole Broxton versus the Phillies bullpen thing ends up being a deciding factor.
And Cheryl becomes so important against their lefty batters, too.
Absolutely. And he's such a warhorse. He'll go out there every day. I just think the Yankees are they're the best team in baseball, and I think that I don't see anyone left with a bullpen that can go through all the, you know, all that's in the middle of that Yankee order late in games. You know, Teixeira and Jeter and A-Rod and so forth. So I just don't see them getting beaten. I'll say this, too. I mean, I've been thinking this a lot. I'm watching Ryan Franklin and Papelbon and all of the angst over relievers in the postseason has made me just appreciate even further that maybe over these last 14 years, the best player in baseball is Mariano Rivera. I mean, he doesn't, you know, okay, he broke three bats in 2001 and the Diamondbacks got lucky. But it is just astounding. There's never been any, there haven't been any of these crises around Mariano Rivera. And to think that he's done it pitching 7 months all but one of those 14 years is even more remarkable. So I don't know how you feel, but I'm not sure he is the greatest modern player in an offensive era.
And he won't have an MVP or a Cy Young Award in his whole career, but he'll have at least four rings.
It's amazing. I mean, I did have a vote this year, and I think I had Mariano fifth in the American League, and I thought about it a lot, and I really wanted, because he is such a gentleman, too. And
is that MVP so or Cy Young?
MVP. Uh-huh. I'd love to have voted him number one, but I couldn't. But it's also a problem when you've got Jeter and Teixeira on the same team. But still, I mean, you're right. I mean, never to have won a major award and be so great that you can make the argument that he was the greatest player of his era is just astounding.
You know, we talked about this earlier, Peter. I mean, Nathan gives up the bomb to A-Rod. Then Papelbon gets, you know, hit fairly hard when he was in there. You mentioned the Ryan Franklin stuff. I mean, this stuff never really happens to Mo. Yeah, he blew those games against the Red Sox in 04. But when has he really given up a bomb? You know what I'm talking about?
I know.
Even the best closers in baseball give up big, loud hits to blow a game. He just doesn't.
I mean, you know, the one bomb was the Sandy Alomar home run in 1997.
Right.
Opposite field.
Right.
And there are several players mentioned to me, if Mariano didn't throw so hard, then we could have never hit it out. I mean, just sort of joking about ice water in his veins. And I remember at the, you know, the day pitchers and catchers reported in 2002, having a cup of coffee with him, and I said, you prepared today for the onslaught of questions about are you over the ninth inning in Arizona? And he said to me, yeah, well, I was really over it by the time we landed in Newark, but I don't want to be smug about it. He said, but, you know, I got up, I walked off the plane, and I said, yeah, I broke three bats. That's the way this job goes. And it's just, I'll never forget it, because he wasn't putting anyone down, as you know. He's too respectful for that. But at the same time, he's right. You know, just it's once in a while, if you're a relief pitcher, you're going to get unlucky.
And made an error, which he never does.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so I got to ask you about Jaramillo. Everybody says he's the best hitting coach in baseball. How is Texas letting him go?
I believe it's money.
Really?
I think there's a little bit of a, I don't know how much there is in terms of a little rift with Nolan Ryan, but that's going to be fascinating to see where he ends up. I mean, I was told he's not going to the Mets.
Why not? Is it because of money?
I don't know. I mean, that's the general manager, Jeff Wilpon. I mean, I don't think the Mets are going to make any changes. And they've got to cut back a little bit on pro scouting and things like that. But I don't think that they would do that at this point. So,
but Omar loves the guy.
Yeah, but he's not the general manager.
Who is?
Jeff Wilpon.
Wow.
Omar's the one who's out there to take the heat.
Interesting stuff. I mean, fascinating stuff. Where's Wagner end up?
He definitely wants to pitch. I mean, you know how emotional he is after games. I don't know. I think that there are a lot of relief pitchers on the merry-go-round this winter. So my guess is that he could go for 1 year to maybe go back to Houston, maybe go to Florida. because they would certainly take him for 1 year at pretty good money, I do believe, and then make a trade for a young guy they think will be a closer. But I think the Marlins think they're so close that someone like Billy makes a lot of sense.
Do you think that, I mean, I keep hearing rumors, Peter, that the Red Sox are going to trade Papelbon. Do you think that's true?
I don't think they will at this point. What they want is Jonathan to get readdressed his focus. He's lost it. The fact is, he's a one-pitch pitcher who's lost 3 miles an hour in velocity. When he first started closing, he worked hard on this. He had a great split. He had a very good slider. He's lost the split. He threw one non-fastball in that Angels outing. And I don't know what you call the pitches when he's intentionally walking Torii Hunter. But he's got to get that split back, and otherwise he'll be average. I think that he loves the limelight. He loves the pressure. He loves the attention. I think that he'll go back to working hard and come back with that split. He'll pitch one more year for the Red Sox, and then they'll trade him with 1 year to go before free agency.
Now, one final thing. Joe Torre said today that after next year when his contract's up, he thinks that's going to do it. He'll be 70 years old. You buy that?
Yes. I do buy that. I could just see him out there surfing in Hawaii, in Maui, you know, reenacting that commercial. But I wouldn't be surprised, and I think a lot of things will probably come out here in the next few months, but I think life with the Dodgers is pretty much a living hell.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's
even worse. So he thought he had a bad in New York, and now it's worse there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There'll be a lot that comes out in time with Dodger ownership, but that is a mess. And I don't think anybody wants to have to put up with it too long.
Wow. Big stuff you've given us, Peter. Big stuff. I guess I'll see you at the stadium on Friday, right?
I certainly will be there.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you popping on with us.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
You got it. Wow. How about that? And Omar's not the GM, Don.
See, the first
time...
That's
the one that your eyes were...
You know, the first time he said it...
Right.
I thought maybe he misspoke.
Well, that's why I...
So, and I guess you caught the same thing, and then when he threw it out, you know what? A lot of Met fans agree with Peter. We've said it here, too, that there's a lot of control that comes down from above there, and unfortunately, they made the mistake of having Omar be the bearer of bad news to people, and the fact that he can't communicate very well makes it worse. But... That doesn't bode well for the Mets' future. No offense to Fred or Jeff, but can they run a baseball team? I mean, did they know enough about baseball to be doing the things that they do?
Wow.
And then, it's a guy that they love,
right.
And they're telling him you can't have him.
And that makes a difference in the way a team performs. Maybe Rudy Jaramillo fixes
right.
David Wright.
And you just wonder how Omar's going to feel about it when you consider he wanted Manny, probably, and couldn't have him either.
We got to talk about this, so hang right there. This is interesting stuff, and with the Mets keeping Omar, and I guess they kept them because the owner's really the GM, and the Joe Torre situation. Wow! Good stuff!
Ready to take with you anywhere. It's the Michael K. Show podcast.
Oh, yeah, it's time for the third hour of the Michael K. Show. It's 4:01 in New York City. Big Sunday. As the Giants are in New Orleans to meet the Saints, and we thought it'd be a great week to talk to Archie Manning, the father of Eli Manning, and he joins us now. Archie, how you doing?
Great, Michael. How you doing, buddy?
Doing very, very well. We had Eli on Monday, as we always do on the show, and he said, you know, he doesn't usually tip his hand that much about being emotional, but he said that this is a big deal for him to be playing in the Superdome. So I started to think, I wonder if it's a big deal for Archie and his wife. So is it a big deal to have your son play at the Superdome?
Oh, well, sure. It's special. You know, Eli grew up here in New Orleans. He spent time. He doesn't remember. He was young when I played there. We moved into the Superdome in 1975. I came to the Saints in 71, so I played in there for several years before I got traded. But Eli's been to a lot of events there. He and my oldest son, Cooper and Peyton, used to go to all the Saints games when I was broadcasting Saints games. And so, yeah, you know, he's coming home. Got a lot of friends will be there. Got a lot of folks from Mississippi coming. A lot of Ole Miss folks. So it's a special time.
Now he told us that when he was a kid and when you were announcing the games that he was always on the field and in the clubhouse. So did he ever say to you, "Hey, Dad, I'm going to play here one day"?
Well, I don't remember Eli saying that. I remember Cooper saying that. My oldest one, he wanted to be a college football player. And I think they all kind of just lined up for that. They played all sports, and it seemed like that was kind of some of their dreams to play. play ball, and they played a lot of sports in high school. And unfortunately, Cooper had an injury, but Peyton and Eli continued to play in college and into pro ball, something I never really expected, never really thought much about. But they worked hard to get there.
I always have heard, so you're the best guy to answer this, that Cooper might have been the best athlete of the three before he got hurt. And how good was Cooper?
Cooper was a good athlete. When he first started playing football, they had him at the quarterback position, and he really didn't feel – well, I'm not sure. I tell you, Cooper wanted to play, and there were a couple of guys lined up in front of him. You know, he was a sophomore, there was a junior and a senior. So Cooper's kind of the salesman of our family. He talked to Coach into moving him to wide receiver. And then it still wasn't much room out there. They kind of ran a wing T, Michael. And he really is a pretty good salesman because he talked the coach into going to three wides, and, you know, so he could get on the field a little bit. So he wound up being a receiver. And Cooper was a good athlete. He was real good. He played on two state championship basketball teams, played baseball. He could run pretty good and had really good hands.
Well, let's talk about Peyton and Eli, and I think I've asked you this before, but I think it bears repeating. Do you and Olivia ever sit down and think and see what your sons have done? And they're not just like members of the NFL, which would be an incredible thing from one family, but they're star players that have won championships, that are doing very well financially. Do you ever look at each other and go, wow, how did we start this?
I think Olivia and I have several times over the last few years. Primarily, Michael, like I said, it wasn't a plan. You know, we just like other folks, we just tried to raise kids. Sure, I was playing professional football here in New Orleans, but I didn't try to wind them up to do that. They were around sports, and I think it's healthy and good for young people to play sports. I think it's good for them to play a lot of sports, which they did. But never did I envision them you know, doing anything beyond high school. And like I said, they wanted to play college ball, and Cooper got hurt, but Peyton and Eli enjoyed a lot of success at college ball. And, you know, for them to go into the NFL as quarterbacks, I pinched myself about that. But kind of what's happened since, it's hard to believe Peyton's in his 12th year, but, you know, a few years ago, where the Colts won a Super Bowl, and then 1 year later the Giants won a Super Bowl. I just, that was a lot. I think Olivia and I looked at each other a lot of times and had to pinch ourselves and just saying, what in the world is going on here?
Now, Peyton never misses a day of work, knock on wood, and Eli with the shoulder last year didn't miss a day of work, and now with the plantar fasciitis. Now, I always say that has to come from the family. Like, I never call in sick because my parents, it wasn't an option with them. You go to work, you're supposed to work, and there's no such thing as sick. Is that something that you drove into the kids when they were young, that, hey, you have a responsibility when you have a job to be out there? Because it seems like for Peyton and Eli, it's a big deal to play every single weekend.
Well, it is. You know, maybe it started. I didn't much believe in taking days off from school. They've been real fortunate now, Michael, as far as injuries. But, you know, you play this game, you get nicked up. But in high school when they were, both of them several times in college when I thought maybe, you know, they weren't going to be able to go that week, they always seemed to come around and play. So they've been very fortunate in high school, college, and pro ball. So I know Eli. It's just a feeling that I think professional players have. You want to play. You're kind of expected to play. Sometimes you can't, and so you sit down. But it's at all possible. You try to. A veteran player told me one time when I was a rookie player, he said, this game's really a lot of fun. It's good until you get hurt, and then it's no fun at all. And it's really true. And then people kind of look at you funny when you're not playing. You know, the other players and the coaches around you just don't feel like you're part of it. You're always in the training room, around the dressing room. People kind of look at you funny.
Now, Archie, excuse me for my ignorance, but did you miss many games when you played, or were you a guy that plowed through everything?
I didn't miss too many. I got beat up a good bit here. Now, I missed a whole year. I had bicep tendonitis in my throwing arm, and I finished the whole season with about 10 games with it. But in the off season, I had to have surgery, and the surgery really didn't work. So I had to go in, and I rehabbed and was trying to play, couldn't, and went in and had another surgery during the season. So I missed one entire year. Other than that, you know, I missed a couple of games with a hamstring. But other than that, I didn't miss too many games.
Now, with the plantar fasciitis, we're talking with Archie Manning here on the Michael Kay Show, 1050 ESPN New York. Did you think that Eli probably wasn't going to play last weekend?
I didn't know. I know it's not a fun injury. It's amazing how many people have that. And, of course, I heard from all of them last week. It's amazing everybody's got their own remedy. It seems like there's about, 30 different ways to get over it, that people have gotten over it. But so I didn't stick my nose in it. I was in New York, and I really didn't bother you. I felt like it came around. It was improving each day. When he told me it was getting a little better each day, I kind of thought he would play. Then I just didn't know what Coach Coughlin would want to do, but I knew Eli wanted to. So I was really pleased the way it worked out.
All right, let's talk about this game coming up on Sunday. Obviously, you know the Saints very well. How's this matchup? Because the Saints are a very, very good team, and you're very familiar with the Giants as well. How do you see this one?
Well, this should be a heck of a football game. Saints are a good team. I don't think the rest of the country has really noticed, everyone has noticed yet how good a team this is. You should start with their quarterback, who's an outstanding player and really runs everything here. And Sean Payton, the coach, has done a great job, and he's a real good play caller, and he and Drew Brees really gel together good. But they got a lot of receivers they use. The offensive line is a very physical group, even with some injuries. They've really impressed me over the last couple of years, Michael, the way they filled in when they get injuries. How some new people have stepped in. That's been the case in their O-line. And this year, probably the biggest difference in their offense, they're running the ball better, and they're doing it with two or three people. So they're really going to be a big test for the Giants defense. On defensively, they haven't been very good the last 2 years, and they're improved. Their secondary is better. Their corners are better, and they're getting better safety play. Vilma in the middle makes a lot of tackles, and even getting a better pass rush out of a couple of number one draft choices who they're kind of getting to a point where I think a lot of people thought they should have been the last few years. So Greg Williams has come in and done a fine job with their defense. So without a doubt, this is the best team the Giants have played. It's a tough place to play. You know, people here in New Orleans are very solid behind this team. It's real loud. So it'll take a maximum effort, maximum play by the Giants to hang in there with this thing.
Will Eli call you up because you know the Saints so well and say, what do you think, Dad? Or is he just going to rely on the film?
No, he doesn't do that. I actually don't know him as well as I used to. I did the radio for 12 years, and I also continued to do their preseason football
right. For
another 5 years. But I quit doing that a couple of years ago. So I really very seldom see him play. I'm kind of busy trying to keep up with the Giants and the Colts. And so I really don't know as much about him as I'm sure he does.
All right. Now, how many people are going to be there? How many Manning family and obviously friends and relatives and stuff like that? How many do you think are
going
to be
there?
Yeah,
we got a pretty good crowd coming, and even some New Orleans people who don't normally go to the Saints games. You don't want to go see Eli. Got a lot of family from Mississippi, a lot of people from Mississippi and Ole Miss fans who are coming down for this game. So they'll, of course, I know the Giants fans, a lot of them always travel well. Of course, people love to come to New Orleans. So there'll be a few sprinkling in there pulling for the Giants, pulling for Eli, but it'll be a tough crowd.
Archie, if you still did Saints games, would it be a difficult broadcast for you on Sunday?
Oh, yeah. I quit when Peyton went into pro ball, Michael. I just said I wouldn't have my heart in it. You know, I'd be sitting there broadcasting a Saints game and wondering what's going on with the Colts. And also, I used to do – one of my jobs was I was always giving scores and a few updates. And I said, I'm not sitting there giving a – you know, saying – you know, the Patriots are leading the Colts 21-7, and Peyton Manning just threw his third interception. I said, I'm not going to be part of that. So I gave it up, and I hadn't really missed it that much. I've enjoyed following the Colts and the Giants for the last few years.
All right, final thing before we let you go, Archie. Obviously, with Hurricane Katrina, a big blow to New Orleans and that area. Has it come all the way back? I mean, have you seen it that it's come all the way back?
No, it hadn't come all the way back. And it's just a... It was such devastation, Michael. You know, it's a good 10-year process. But we're 4 years into it. We've made a lot of steps. Sometimes down here we take one step forward and two back. But You know, all the things that people like to do in New Orleans are ready for them. You know, our hotels, our convention facilities, our restaurants are all up and running and in good shape. So we need people to – I'm glad some Giants fans are coming this weekend, and they will enjoy New Orleans. It's great hospitality down here as we continue to try to recover from Katrina.
So it's kind of the surrounding outlying areas that still need help?
Yeah, they're still tough, Michael. The ones that got hit so hard, the two or three areas that got hit so hard, there hadn't been that much, you know, done there, and it still looks pretty tough. But the rest of the city is okay. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, this football team, this organization's really been good emotionally for this town. It was a devastating thing. And the Saints, they've been off a little bit the last couple of years. You remember 3 years ago they won an NFC championship game, and this year people are very excited about their team. So it's done a lot for them, I think, emotionally.
Archie, we thank you for popping on. I hope you have a great time this weekend. It's probably very, very exciting, and we always appreciate when you can come on with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Michael. Always glad to be with you. Thank
you. Thank you so much. That's Archie Manning, and this is going to be a good game, Don. This is not an easy game to pick, and you know, a lot of people have said, well, now the Giants are starting to play the varsity. If you look at the first five games the Giants have played, they should have won every single one of them, and they did, and they did it handily. This is the first time they're really, really getting tested. Maybe we thought the Redskins at the beginning that was a test, but we've seen that the Redskins are dreadful. Giants have won the games they're supposed to win. Saints are going to be a test.
Interesting stat for the Redskins, and I didn't even think about it until I read it on Tuesday, that every team they've played did not have a win. And the Giants was opening day, right, so they didn't have a win. And everybody they played has been winless. And so the Redskins are not a perfect team. Dallas, they probably should have lost that game, but they found a way to win it. That's easily the toughest team that they've played in the atmosphere in which they played.
Yes, that's
the
true.
One thing going for the Giants is they don't seem to worry about playing games on the road. So maybe
seem
the fact
like they embrace it.
Yeah, I think they actually may be a better team on the road. So maybe that works well for the Giants. This is a test because the Saints, we know how great they are offensively, but watching that Jet game a couple of weeks ago, they're very good defensively. They're top 10 defense. So if Eli's not 100%, they get in his face a little bit. That is going to be a test. Giants win on Giants lose. Hey, they're still 5-1. Everything's okay. But if they win this game, then you really have to ask yourself, what's a team in the NFC that's going to challenge the Giants? And then the Eagles would probably be the next team that they'd face that would be a really huge test. But you start knocking some teams by the wayside if they win on Sunday.
Now, how about this, Don? You'll be proud of me. I could choose to fly with the Yankees on Saturday night after the game, go across country to go to Anaheim, or I could actually go on Sunday at some point because the game's on Monday. I'm choosing to fly with the Yankees simply because I want to watch the Giants-Saints game. I want to be there in time to watch the Giants-Saints game. I want football Sunday in the hotel.
But are you going to be able to watch the game? Is that game going to be available in Los Angeles?
I believe that that's the national game.
Okay.
Right? That's
yeah,
that,
and you don't have to worry about any conflicts in Los Angeles.
We're not worried about the Rams.
You're in the middle of the Michael K. Show podcast.
Here's a great, great broadcaster, though, and that's Buck Showalter. He joins us now. Buck, how you doing?
Well, I was doing real good until I'm walking around here at ESPN, and their MLB network is playing back the 95 Seattle Yankee game, and so I'm a little down, Mike.
Do you know, Buck, that there's a guy that's written an entire book about that's coming out in January, and the title of the book is The Greatest Postseason Series Ever Played?
And never asked me one question about it.
No way. He never asked you a question?
So he beat me out. I was going to get my book out there. Gosh.
That was a great series, Buck. I know it didn't end the way you wanted. Chris Donnelly is the guy's name. But that was a phenomenal series, and it changed the course of two organizations.
Thanks, Mike. Certainly changed my life.
Wait a second. They asked you to come back. You had already gone already.
They asked me to come back twice, but was with four or five coaches fired, depending on what time of the day it was.
You should have come back. Your life would have been so different. So would have mine. So would have Joe Torre's.
But, Mike, think about how much I impacted those four or five coaches that I took with me.
Excellent point. But okay. A lot of managers let their coaches get thrown under the bus.
It still amazes me how these managers just go, okay, well, so he was what I thought was the best hitting coach ever, but if it's him or me, well, he's got to go. It still shocks me when I watch how coaches managers don't stand up for their people.
Well, it's amazing because the guy who ended up following you as a Yankee manager, he let coach after coach go. I mean, chapter and verse, Jose Cardinal, Rick Down, over and over and over again. If the Yankees said you got to get rid of this guy, he did, and then, the way it turned out.
Maybe I should learn a lesson from that.
We all learn, Buck, as we get older.
Yes, we do, Michael. What do you think about the series?
Well, let me ask you one more question about a coach, Rudy Jaramillo. You had him there. Are you surprised that he's no longer with Texas? Because we had on Steve Phillips, and Steve said that that'd be the first hire he would make if he was a GM. He said, I want the best coaching staff in the world. So what, are you shocked by that?
Shocked not anymore by that in Texas, but, they did offer him a one-year deal. Rudy's got a lot of pride, and he feels like, through his accomplishments that was probably a little slap in the face for him, and he'll land on his feet, believe me. I think he'd be a great match somewhere. I know what, if I was a hitting coach out there that had a so-so year, I'd be a little shaky right now.
What makes him so good, Buck?
He has great rapport with the players, regardless of their backgrounds or what have you. He just, and he will call BS on the guy with a 10-year contract and the guy with his first year. He treats everybody the same. If he tells you you're hitting at 4 o'clock and you walk in there at 4:01, there's a problem. But Rudy has great technique. He's very consistent. He has a great track record of success with players. And, mechanically he's very sound and he's very focused, hard worker, and he doesn't tolerate anybody not willing to put in the time. And there's always a return if you'll just trust him. He develops, I think more than anything, Mike, he develops a great trust with his hitters.
Well, that's high praise from you, because when you got the Ranger job, you inherited him, and he wasn't one of your guys. It sounds like you really liked him.
Well, Mike, I had a lot of guys over the years that weren't initially one of my guys. I'm not going to penalize somebody and their family and their kids and everything just because they don't have a prior relationship with me. If that spot's there, that's part of the agreement. When you go into a place, there's certain guys, and I would have taken Rudy anyway, but I'm not going to penalize DeMarlo Hell or Steve Smith or a lot of these guys that I had when I walked in there. In fact, I offered Terry Francona if he wanted to stay on. It worked out pretty good for him going somewhere else because, just to come in and coldly get rid of everybody because you didn't know them before you walked in there, I don't think is very ethical.
Now, let's talk about these series, Buck. I'm excited about both of them. I think they could be a lot of fun. Let's start with the Yankees and the Angels. How do you see this one playing out?
Mike, the Yankees got their hands full. I will tell you that. I like the Saunders start in game two. I was looking today. There are 9 left-handed starters in the postseason pitching in the first 2 or 3 games. That gives you an idea how left-handed plays as you positively with clubs, and that's why everybody's always looking for them. With Pettit and Sabathia going 5 of the 7 games, that means Posada's going to catch 5 of the 7. Is that correct?
Yes.
Which puts a lot of pressure on those guys to hold runners. They're going to be very susceptible to the stolen base of third base. Not to throw Jorge under the bus. He'll throw out the guys he's supposed to throw out, but if they're going first movement on those guys, but Andy should be able to shut it down, and CeCe's pretty good with it. I think it's a fascinating series, all of them. For the first time in a long time, we have the 4 best teams in the playoffs, and these 2 immovable objects, so to speak, they're having these great years, and all of a sudden they're going to clash, and I really see these both series going 7 games. I think they're going to be fascinating to watch.
I think it's a really gutsy call by Mike Socia to go with Saunders in game 2, because Peter Gammons had thought they were going to go with the 2 right-handers at Yankee Stadium, which plays into Yankee Stadium. But to use Saunders in game 2, I always look at a gutsy move as a move that, hey, if it doesn't work out, the guy's really going to be second-guessed. And, Tony Saunders, Joe Saunders is pretty much their fourth starter. And to use him in game 2, I think it's a really bright move, but also a little bit of a gamble.
Well, I like it. And same way reason Kershaw starting game 1 for the Dodgers. They've done that differently too. And you've got to think out of the box, and one thing that the good managers in the postseason, one thing Joe Torre does very well is that they grasp the finality and the day-to-day, and in Joe Girardi's case, throwing feelings a little bit out the book and doing what's best with your catching situation sometimes. And I applaud them for it, because you're gonna be second guessed one way or the other. You let the statistics verify a gut feeling, and Saunders is a good matchup. He's been pitching a little bit better later on, and I think it's the right move, win, lose, or draw. It's not like Weaver's not going to pitch.
Buck, I love the move of the Yankees using 3 starters, because the way the ALCS is configured, only 1 starter has to pitch on short rest, and that's CeCe, and then you could get him on normal rest if there's a game 7. Do you agree with going with 3, or would you have gone with Godin?
No, I like going with 3. That's for best three guys. They run them out there. The one challenge it's going to present, though, if you look at the Angels lineup, they're very predominantly right-handed, including the switch hitters. The only left-hander in the lineup is going to be Abreu, and he handles left-hand pitching very well this year. So that is going to be one challenge. You're going to see, but, you know, good left-hand starters at big league level. One thing you ask your minor league people, how does the left-handed prospect get right-handed hitters out? Because you may see three left-handed or four in the lineup because the prospects stay in the lineup in the minor leagues. When you come to the big leagues, you're going to see 7 to 9 right-handed hitters because everybody makes out their roster. How are you going to face a left-handed starter with your club? And they're going to see plenty of right-handed hitters because that is what Anaheim is predominantly going to feature.
Now, I heard you on Baseball Tonight last night. You think the Angels are going to squeeze this out in 7 games?
They back me in a corner with that. They always want you to make a play. I don't know. It's like Harold Reynolds one time, we were doing a pregame show for College World Series, and they asked Harold who was going to win, and he said, "Are you think I'm going to predict what an 18- or 19-year-old guy is going to do for 10 days? You're nuts." But that's what they wanted. If I had to pick, you know, I like the idea they got a left-handed closer against the Yankees. I think that plays well. I think the Yankees have a little bit better situation in their bullpen. A big guy in the series I think is going to be Darren Oliver. I know that sounds crazy, but the ability to get a left-handed hitter out in the 7th or 8th inning is going to be, that's something that Anaheim has not had in the past.
Now, do you buy into the fact you've been around a lot of ballplayers in your life? You were a ballplayer yourself, and, you know, I was talking to Alex after the 3rd game against the Twins, and he just said, you know what, Mike, I'm just a happier person. I'm in a good spot in my life, and I'm happy on the field. I'm happy off the field. Has he finally turned a corner, and do you think that he can have a good ALCS against this Angel team?
I hope so. I think each series is different. You know, we were talking to Larry Boa last night, and as great as things seem to be going for the Dodgers, he was talking about it seems like Hamels throws his glove out on the field, and Hamels has been struggling, and the Dodgers can't show up. So I look at each series different. Each mentality is different. You know, the first game is so pivotal. It's such a snowball time of the year. Some guy gets it going, a couple of flare base hits, and all of a sudden everything seems to fall in place. Manny swinging a bat better last game. I thought Guerrero's base hit to center field after walking Hunter has really set him up in a new mental frame of mind. And Alex is in a great frame of mind. Now, if he goes 0-for-5 with 3 punch outs the first game, you know, where's the mentality going to be after that? And that's why you have to be so strong mentally. But, you know, I'm happy for Alex. He's had enough people question his postseason.
Talking with Buck Showalter here on the Michael Kay Show, 1050 ESPN New York. Let's look at the National League Series, which is another good one. Buck, and I agree with you. There's no wild cards in here, and that's not a knock on the wild card. These are the best teams, I think, in baseball. How do you see the Phillies in the Dodgers series?
Well, you know, the Phillies have that pedigree. You know, I think 1 through 6, they may have the best pure hitters of all the teams in baseball. I do. Their 1 through 6 is just filthy to have to match up against. And their left-handers handle, you know, they see so much left-hand pitching. One thing about the left-hand hitters that stay in the lineup against left-handers, they see a lot of left-hand pitching. That's why right-handers hit right-handers better than left-handers hit left-handers, because during the course of the career, they see so many more like-side pitchers. I think what gets missed about these two clubs is how well they defend. They can turn hits in the outs in the middle of the field. Furkall, and I tell you what, fans around the country are really going to get, especially East Coast fans, are going to get a good look at Abar. I didn't want to miss him. He's probably the most turning hits in the outs guy, with exception of maybe Torrey Hunter that will be on the field during the postseason. But Furkall's had a great year. Casey Blake has just been a rock for them. You look at the bench of the Dodgers, and when you talk about Orlando Hudson, you talk about Juan Pierre, you're talking about Tommy, Brad Ausmus. I mean, they present some real issues late in the ballgame. So I don't think there's a team in the playoffs, though, that has a better pure bullpen than the Dodgers. When you have two left-handers and two right-handers that you feel comfortable about leaving in against an opposite side hitter. I mean, Sherrill's close against left and right. Quo is just filthy against left and right. Belisario's been outstanding. And, of course, Broxton at the end. And you got four guys. I think more than anybody, they're playing a 5 or 6 inning ball game. You better have a lead going into the 6th and 7th inning against the Dodgers.
Now, do you think that Charlie Manuel has faith in Lidge? I know he brought him in for the last 2 games, but remember in the last game, he went with Ayer to start in a 1-run 9th inning lead and then went to Lidge for the final out, so I don't think he has total faith in him yet. Is that going to play a factor in this series?
Well, Charlie's fly like a fox. I chuckle when people question him sometimes, but they're playing game 5 if Charlie doesn't start the inning that way. He got to the matchup that Lidge could handle. Scotty Harris gave up a base hit to a left-hander, but he kept him in the ballpark. And I don't think if he didn't match up that way in the last inning, I don't think they get those outs. And I think you'll see him piece it together as they go. And the thing that you got to keep in mind that though everything looks this way right now, the playoffs are a moving target. You know, if somebody goes down 2-0, they're going to deal with game three a completely different than what was on paper when they started the series.
I look at the way the Yankees played the Twins, and I wonder if you got this as well, Buck. They swept the series, so it's hard to complain, but I thought that in every single one of the games, Girardi was completely overboard with his managerial moves for the bullpen. And in game two, he left himself with nobody but Chad Godin. Game one, I thought he went to the bullpen a little bit too soon and too late with Mariano. And then in game three, he took out Andy Pettit, 81 pitches, went out into the seventh inning to go to Jabba. So my question to you is this, Buck. As a manager, how differently do you manage in the playoffs than the way you did during the regular season to get you there?
Well, I think the guys that are successful, and one thing I've learned watching them over the years, the guys that grasp the sense of finality with every out, every game, you know, let's worry about tomorrow, instead of sometimes during the season you may bite the bullet so you have a chance to be more productive starting a road trip or whatever. But I can't fault, you know, Joe knows his players. He knows where he is. He sat there and watched Joe manage in the postseason, and I'd always make them the error on the side of going, you know, you let the stats come after you have a gut feeling. The guys that let all the stats just dictate what they do get in trouble. You know, you let the statistical stuff verify what your gut and your coaches tell you, and you're dealing with human beings, and it's such a big part of this, of having a grasp on where your team is mentally and emotionally, your players, so to speak. There are certain things that you know from being on a plane, being in the clubhouse, being with these guys every day. You know what mental state of mind a guy's in, and you have to grasp that and put them in the best positions to have success.
Buck, sometimes we get addicted to the radar gun, and I see Phil Hughes is throwing the same on the radar gun as he did in August. He's about 94, and I could swear watching him pitch that he doesn't have the same explosive late life that he did in August as he does now. Is there any legitimacy to that, even though the number is the same?
Oh, without a doubt. There's a, you know, the things that should tell you, and this is where numbers and graphs and stats don't, you know, the hitters will tell you. You see how they're fouling balls off. You see if they're trying to hit a guy early in the count to stay away from getting to a certain pitch. Even the way the guy's catching the ball. I mean, you know your catchers, you watch, you know, if they're struggling to catch a ball with late life, where they're catching them easily, are they pulling the ball off of him? You really try to take a picture mentally when a guy's on top of his game, so you know when he's not at that level. And there's so many things that show you whether that guy, regardless of the gun readings, is still carrying that Christmas it takes to get people out consistently.
Who do you like in the National League Series?
Yep, that's a tough one there too, Mike. You work for ESPN?
Yes, I do.
I still think that I like the Dodgers bullpen. I really do. If they can put some runs on the board early, they got to solve the left-handed thing, and you know, they pretty much got a chance to take Ethier out of the equation a little bit because he struggles so much against left-hand pitching. And it's going to be fascinating to watch. But I tell you, that bullpen with the Dodgers is going to be tough to match up with late in the game.
I saw you yesterday, as I mentioned, on Baseball Tonight. It looked like you and Kruk really get along.
Oh, he's special. John doesn't take himself too seriously, and I think the one thing I hope we both bring is that we don't forget how tough the game is to play, and how bad we were at times playing it or coaching or managing, and you have a respect for what's going on between those lines. And, you know, sometimes we take it too seriously. I'm genuinely excited about watching these next, what I think are going to be 14 games, because this.
How great that would be! But that would be great for baseball.
I think it's got a good chance to happen. I just don't see anybody folding over and not making this competitive.
I'm going to make one final question because I know you love these sorts of questions. So are
Mike,
you up for
you're the best at these, Mike. Come
are
on.
You are you up for any of the managerial jobs that are open,
Michael?
Buck.
Yep. Am I up emotionally, or am I getting calls?
Are you getting calls?
Oh, Mike, I'm getting calls, but...
Are you going to get one of them? I think you should, because I think you're great.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike, but, you know, there's a lot of good people out there, and...
None better than you.
Well, I appreciate it. I talked to the general manager when they hired A.J. Hinch, and Arizona when he was catching a lot of flack from them. And I told him, I said, you know, a long time ago, somebody took a chance on me and nobody, you know, thought well of it, so to speak, with lack of experience at the major league level. And thank goodness somebody had the guts to do that. And I look around at some of the guys like Tim Bogar and DeMarlo Hale and some of the young names that are being mentioned out there. You know, I hope they get an opportunity. And more importantly, I hope nobody gets fired, because I know what that emotion's like. And these people that are talking about jobs that other people currently have and coveting things, it's just not the right way to do it. And if I get the honor of doing it again, you know, it'll be as much honor as it was back in 92. And we'll see what the good Lord has plans for me. And, you know, I'm happy here, and we'll see where life takes me. But, you know, there's a lot of quality people out there deserving of a chance.
Can I be a bench coach, something like that, if you get another gig?
Mike, that's a lot tougher. Everybody says, I just want to be the bench coach. It's tough, because when you turn to the guy and you go, I used to turn to Cleet Boris, and I'd go, Cleet, what do you think about da-da-da? He goes, well, that's a tough one, Buck. That's why you're the manager.
I'll give you an answer. You know me. I'll give you an answer.
I know you would,
it might
Mike.
Not be right, but I'll give you an answer.
The toughest job right now, this time of year, is the traveling secretary. Can you imagine trying to go back and forth across the countries and trying to get the hotels with no reservations and bingo, bango, trying to do the tickets? It's a challenge. You better have a good traveling secretary, and that will be the difference in the series. Who has the best traveling secretary?
That's big. So I wanted to know the key, and now it's going to be Ben Tulowitzki for the Yankees is going to decide whether or not they win. Very
just
nice.
Just a little more pressure there.
Buck, thanks for coming on.
All right, Mike. Thanks for having me. I'll take care. Good luck.
All right.
Stay warm.
Good. That's Buck Showalter of ESPN.
This has been the Michael K. Show Podcast. Exclusive interviews and nonstop Team 1050 coverage. Thanks for listening to the Michael K. Show Podcast. We'll be right back.